You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 189 by Dr. Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, entitled Conscious Society, Anthroposophy, and the Social Question. 8 lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 1st of March, 1919. In the course of these reflections, I have drawn attention to the fact, apparent as humanity evolves, that deep within the human soul, in the unconscious interior of the human soul, something quite different can occur from what manifests at a more surface level. As we have often heard, a person can think that he is striving for a particular thing, whereas in truth he bears in the depths of his soul impulses that tend in a very different direction. This is a truth of particular relevance today. Nowadays, we see a whole class of human beings in the grip of a particular type of will, one we have often spoken of. And precisely here, we find something developing at the soul's surface. Consciousness developing in this age of the consciousness soul, which is very, very different from impulses in the soul's depths that seek realization, and of which today nothing real is as yet present in our consciousness. If we study what lives in the consciousness of the modern proletariat, we find it to be filled with three things, as we have often mentioned. Firstly, a materialistic view of history. Secondly, the view that everything that happens in the world has always so far been founded on class warfare, that this class warfare accounts for everything that happens, and that what appears to be different in nature is only a reflection of this. And thirdly, as I have often characterized it, the doctrine of, in quotes, added value, which concerns the additional value accruing from workers' unpaid labor, constituting the profit the employer takes from the worker without the latter receiving any remuneration for it. Basically, proletarian consciousness is constituted of these three aspects and gives rise to the impulses from which the modern social movement draws the various views and judgments at work in it. This is what lives in the mind of the proletarian class. But three other things live in the consciousness of modern humanity, live also in the deeper layers of soul of the proletariat, and elicit their feelings especially. But the world today normally has very little awareness of these three things. The world does not seek much self-knowledge, and therefore knows nothing of what lives in the depths of the soul, and strives to be realized in history. These three other things are, firstly, a penetration of spiritual life in a way appropriate for our era, what we can call spiritual science of one kind or another. The second is freedom in our life of thinking, freedom of thought. And the third is socialism, in the genuine sense of the word. The proletariat, too, strive for these three things, but know nothing of them. And in their instincts, they pursue the other three things which, as I said, work at the surface of soul life, in their conscious mind. There is a complete contrast, it is clear, between conscious strivings of the proletariat and their subconscious impulses. Consider the materialistic outlook, which emerged from the materialism of the modern era over the past 4 centuries. Amongst the ruling classes of mankind, this materialism first made itself felt in the field of science, spreading from there to all academic disciplines in general. amongst the modern proletariat, which basically simply adopted the legacy of the scientifically oriented academic mode of thinking, this turned into a materialistic view of history. And this assumes that all spiritual and cultural life is really only a kind of vapor rising from the activities of economic life, from everything occurring in the domain of economic life. This outlook considers that the only realities in human life must be ascribed to the production of goods, trade, and consumption, and that depending on the ways in which the economy was organized in a particular era, people cultivated this or that religious belief, this or that form of art, and this or that legal and ethical system. Cultural life is here seen largely as an ideology. That is, it has no intrinsic reality, but is a reflection of the economic struggles and battles occurring in the world. The thoughts and ideas people formulate, their artistic feelings, whatever they express in moral intentions, can work back in turn on these economic struggles. But ultimately, it is thought. All culture is a reflection of outer economic life. And this is more or less the materialistic view of history. But if human life is only a mirror image of merely external material economic forces, and if, in addition, the world is only a sensory arena, and human thoughts only reflect sensory reality, and if human beings seek only to think about and acknowledge as real what is manifest in the sense world, then they turn their back on all true life of the spirit. And this means, in turn, that they dispense with any idea of an independent, inwardly self-contained spirit within them. In the modern era, people have increasingly sought to offer proofs that there is no such thing as an independent spirit alive in the supersensible realm, that spirit itself does not exist. This sense of things lives at the surface of modern soul life and largely constitutes the content of modern consciousness since the advent of the era of the consciousness soul. But in the profoundest depths of soul life, nevertheless, modern humanity is seeking for the spirit. It has what one might call a deep and inmost need for it. A glance at human evolution and human history can demonstrate this. We have often cast our gaze back to the distinctive disposition and outlook of the early post-Atlantean period, that of early Indian culture. We characterized this era from all kinds of perspectives, and anyone who can look at things with an open mind will have learned that the spiritual way of life and thought at that ancient time, the Indian cultural period as only spiritual science can properly discern it, is founded on unconscious intuitions. Please note that I say unconscious intuitions, for the life of spirit and culture at that time was atavistic. In this first post-Atlantean cultural epoch, we can say unconscious intuitions were the fount and wellspring of cultural life. Then, as we move forward through evolution, we come to the ancient Persian epoch, and seeking its source, we will find that this cultural and spiritual life of ancient Persia flowed from unconscious inspirations. The cultural life of the third epoch, that of Egypt Chaldea, flowed from unconscious imaginations. This Egyptian Chaldean life of culture finds its way into the earliest historical records. And if we look at history without preconceptions, we can discover that unconscious imaginations living in the soul faculties of Egyptians and Chaldeans composed their ancient forms of knowledge. Then followed the Greco-Roman epoch, Imaginations still survived in the culture of those times, but they began now to be pervaded by concepts and ideas. A salient aspect of Greek culture was that the Greeks were the first people in human evolution to possess a new inner faculty, that of ideas and concepts. I have described this in more detail in my book titled Riddles of Philosophy. Nevertheless, all the concepts of the Greeks were imbued with a pictorial quality, with imaginations. People overlook this nowadays, especially in that peculiar version of Greek culture taught in grammar schools and universities. When a Greek said the word idea, for instance, this was something he saw in his mind's eye, EYE, not a merely abstract concept as it has become for us today. When he uttered this word, he had the sense that something visionary hovered before him, which then, however, was clearly formulated in a concept. It was something tangible and seen. Idea is, at the same time, sight. You couldn't have had the word ideology in ancient Greece, really, even though this word is taken from the Greek. Or at least you couldn't have had it with the sense and meaning with which it has been endowed today. And this was because ideas were, for the ancient Greek, something imbued with image. Number one, ancient Indian cultural epoch. Unconscious intuitions as the source of culture. Number two, ancient Persian cultural epoch. Unconscious inspirations as the source of cultural life. Number three, Egypto-Chaldean cultural epoch, unconscious imaginations as the source of cultural life. Number four, Greco-Roman cultural epoch, unconscious imaginations with ideas. Number five, modern era, concepts that strive toward imaginations. Now, the curious thing is that in our fifth post-Atlantean era, imaginations have, for the time being, faded and been lost, leaving the concepts of the consciousness soul. Our modern culture is so prosaic and dry, with everything pictorial squeezed out of it, leaving only the abstraction which people who aspire to be cultured and educated are especially fond of. The modern age feeds on abstractions and seeks to reduce everything, really everything, to some abstract concept or other. We find the abstract concept holding sway most comprehensively, precisely in what people regard as their civic pragmatism. But in the depths of human souls, something else is already stirring. And this is characteristic of the time we are in now, and will be so especially in the near future. In their subconscious impulses, people are turning again toward imaginations, striving toward them. So we can speak of concepts seeking to be imaginations again. Our spiritual science addresses this search for imaginations. But the large majority of humankind is as yet unaware of these underdepths of the soul. People therefore regard culture in terms of mere concepts, mere ideas, which leave them fairly helpless. Concepts as such are devoid of content. And hitherto it has been the fate of the governing classes to develop increasingly a penchant for purely conceptual thinking, which in turn gave rise to something else. This purely conceptual thinking is impotent and engenders an adherence, a dependency, on the reality that cannot be refuted because it is available to the senses, outward sense reality. This belief in merely outward sensory reality has very largely arisen from modern humanity's conceptual impotence. The impotence of conceptual life comes to expression in all realms of culture. In science, the chief focus is on experimentation, so as to allow something to emerge that does not otherwise figure in the sense world, since if you merely reflect on the sense world, you never get beyond it. Concepts themselves contain no reality. In art, people have increasingly become accustomed to worshipping the model, still life, adhering entirely to outer objects. And it has largely been the fate of leading figures in humanity, so far, to aspire evermore to a kind of mere study of external sensory reality. They endeavored increasingly to grasp and record outward sense reality, losing sight of how to draw on the spirit and present this through the medium of art. Naturalism became the aim, an imitation of what nature presents to our outward senses, and this was because abstract culture had no fount or spring from which something autonomous could be drawn and fashioned. If you consider the development of modern art, you will find confirmation of this everywhere. These newer arts sought naturalism as far as possible, a representation of outer perceptions of reality. In the end, this culminated in what was called Impressionism. Prior to this, artists were seeking to depict outer objects. But then came those who drew the ultimate consequence of all this. It seemed to them that when looking at a human figure or a forest and painting them, they were not actually reproducing their true impressions. How could they be true to nature, they wondered, if the sun shines on foliage in one way at one moment, but then the light changes again and creates quite different conditions? They saw that they could not precisely record what the outer world showed them, since it keeps assuming a different countenance. Or in trying to paint a smiling person, they were aware that his face might change a moment later into some quite different expression of frown, say. Should they therefore paint the frown over the smile? If I want to depict the enduring nature of objects in time, this will constrain the objects themselves. Natural scenes cannot be constrained, but human subjects can be, by getting the model to sit very still and hold a single pose or expression as far as possible. But if you try to paint them like this, they will easily appear rigid, frozen, if you are seeking to be naturalistic. That doesn't work. And so these artists became impressionists, trying only to record their immediate transient impression. But then you cannot be entirely naturalistic anymore, but must use all kinds of means, not to imitate nature as such, but to evoke the appearance, the impression, which nature makes on you at any particular moment. And here lay the problem. To be absolutely naturalistic, people turned to Impressionism. And yet in Impressionism, they could no longer be naturalistic. Everything was reversed. And now some tried no longer to depict impressions, no longer to record outer impressions, but to give shape to what rose up within them, however primitive this might be. They sought to hold fast to the inner response rising within them, and these artists became expressionists instead. We could trace the same development in the realm of moral life, and even in the life of rites. Everywhere this striving that arises from a predilection for abstract culture. You just have to study recent developments in humanity in the right way, and then you will discover the search for abstraction everywhere. What became of this for the modern proletariat? When it was harnessed to the factory, to the machine, harnessed to modern soulless capitalism, the whole destiny of the proletarians became chained to economic life. The same way of thinking that led the cultured elite to naturalism gave the proletariat a doctrine that manifests in the materialistic view of history. Wherever one looks, one sees that the proletariat merely drew the ultimate consequences of what had developed amongst the bourgeois class. Consequences from which the members of this same class step back in such horror and alarm. And what was the stance toward religion amongst these bourgeois circles? In one respect, for instance, religious attitudes remained as follows. Formerly, people had obscure, atavistic ideas about the Christ mystery. They had developed various ideas about how Christ dwelt within Jesus. During the 19th century, abstract culture meant that people could no longer picture how Christ lived within Jesus, and so they confined themselves to the sense-perceptible events that had unfolded at the beginning of the Christian era, to mere Jesuology. Jesus was increasingly seen as an outward person. The Christ who belongs to the world of spirit increasingly faded from view. Abstract soul life found no path to Christ and made do with Jesus instead. What did proletarian consciousness make of this? In the proletarian mind, it seemed that there was no particular need for any special religious view of Jesus. The middle classes had already made Jesus into the, quote, simple man of Nazareth, close quote. And since the working classes saw themselves as dependent on economic life, they thought this must have been true of him too. It seemed to them that he said what he did based on the economic circumstances in which he found himself, and that no one, therefore, should ascribe to him any special mission outside of this simple, plain existence. They believed that one should just study the economic conditions that prevailed in Palestine when Christianity began, and would discover, in the process, why Jesus said what he did, why he threw down the tools of his trade and wandered around uttering all kinds of ideas. One of the ultimate consequences of modern Protestant theology is the materialistic Jesus doctrine of the modern proletariat, which no longer has any power to sustain our humanity. As far as the second thing is concerned, freedom in thinking, inner initiative in thought, once again, it is modern humanity's subconscious, deeper soul interior that seeks this. What lives at the conscious surface of the soul believes that it should strive for the very opposite, and does indeed do so. And so the subconscious rumbles in radical opposition, and this conflict comes to expression in the terrible battles that rage nowadays. The modern ruling classes seek to shake off any higher authority, and yet they have tipped over into all kinds of faith in authority. Above all, they have fallen into a blind faith in the authority of the state, which has become the highest idol for the bourgeoisie. Nothing seems more important to the middle classes today than a, quote, professional judgment, close quote. They turn to the, in quotes, experts at every opportunity, and allow these professional verdicts to inform their outward lives. Anyone who enters public life with the rubber stamp of a university degree is apparently qualified to say what's what. If he is a theologian, he can be asked what God is planning for humanity. If he is a jurist, you can ask him about the nature of the law. If he is a physician, you can ask him about human health. And if he has emerged from any of the philosophy faculties, you can ask him absolutely anything about the world. Some at least have always smiled when any reference was made to a book by the venerable pre-Kantian philosopher Wolff, the title of which is roughly, quote, On the Nature of the Human Soul, On the State, On History, and On All Rational Matters in General, close quote. People smile at the title, and yet leading circles in modern times hold firmly to the view that the whole content of reasoned discourse is to be found brewing in the mental laboratories that the state has established for human benefit. In other words, these leading circles, the ruling classes, have made no efforts whatsoever for all people to develop their own minds, but instead cultivate a uniform mentality, trying to ensure that this is basically a state-governed mentality. Modern consciousness has become state consciousness to a far greater degree than people actually credit. They think of the state as their God, which gives them what they require. They need not concern themselves with things directly, since the state will ensure that all rational aspects of life are regulated for them. The proletariat was excluded from involvement in the life of the state, excepting for a few areas where democratic structures were built into it. The working classes, with the labor that encompasses and draws upon the whole of a person's nature, were instead harnessed to economic activity. And in turn, the workers drew the ultimate consequence of this for their life. The modern, middle-class citizen has a state consciousness, even if he doesn't always admit this, and gladly creates more and more state with this state consciousness. Besides having your business cards printed with the appellation, quote, Reserve Lieutenant and Professor, close quote, there are many other ways of making state. But the proletarians had no interest in the state. They were harnessed to economic life, and therefore their feelings became the ultimate consequence of middle-class feeling, but in a manner appropriate to their lives. Their consciousness became the class consciousness of the proletariat. And so we can see, really, since the proletariat has nothing to do with the state, that this class consciousness is founded on internationalism. These things are inevitable. The bourgeois mentality only inclined to the state because it tends to middle-class needs, and the middle-class classes wish to be tended. But the state doesn't look after the proletarians, and so they only feel connected to the world insofar as they belong to their class, the working class. And this proletarian class has proceeded in the same way in all countries and states. For this reason, the international proletariat developed and felt itself to be in stark and conscious opposition to all bourgeois existence, yet strove with this power of consciousness for statehood, for state-like factors. In the modern era, the development of this class consciousness within the proletariat has assumed extraordinary suggestive forms. I don't know how many of you have ever attended proletarian rallies and assemblies. How have such assemblies always concluded? Invariably, they conclude by imitating, albeit in proletarian consequence, what so many bourgeois assemblies trumpet, based on their bourgeois interests. In Central Europe, for instance, governing assemblies always used to begin or end with three cheers for the Kaiser. And in turn, every proletarian assembly concludes with something like, quote, Long live international revolutionary social democracy, close quote. Just consider how hugely suggestive such a phrase must become when heard week in, week out, how it conjures a sense of unity amongst the masses, inevitably putting paid to all freedom in thinking. Such things embed themselves in the soul. Although this happens less and less now, in the past there were assemblies called by middle-class institutions to which social democrats were also invited. The chair of the assembly would say at the end of the gathering, quote, I now request that the social democrats leave the room for a moment, since I am about to invite the members to stand and offer three cheers for the Kaiser, close quote. And, in turn, there were proletarian assemblies to which the gentry were sometimes admitted. And at the end the chair of the meeting would say, quote, "I now request the gentlemen of the bourgeois class to leave the room, since we are going to offer three cheers for international revolutionary social democracy," close quote. Thus the unifying, uniform class consciousness that pervaded human souls was cast from one mold as the very opposite of what sits deeper in human hearts, the opposite of the longing for individual freedom of thought, for individual configuring of the mind. That is the second thing. The third thing that lives in the depths of the modern soul and urgently seeks to be realized is socialism. A socialism that we can simply characterize by saying that in the era of consciousness, the modern soul seeks to feel itself as part of the social organism. There is a desire to found the social organism as such, as a human being to feel oneself an intrinsic part of this social organism, to stand within it in some way. In other words, a desire lives in people to be pervaded by the sense and feeling that as a human being, whatever I do in a way that tells me how much the social organism participates in me and how much I participate in it. We live, after all, within the social organism. But as I said, a sense for this social organism today is only present in subconscious regions of the soul. When a painter paints a picture today, he will rightly say that he needs to be paid for it, since he has invested his art and craft in it. What is his art? Something that society, the social organism, first facilitated for him. Of course, it does depend on his karma, his former lives on earth. But people no longer believe in this, although they are naturally mistaken. But insofar as we do not credit the part played in our skills and ability by the individuality who descends at birth from higher regions, we are entirely dependent for our abilities on the social organism. But modern people take no account of this, remain unaware of it. And so, instead of a social sense, for the past 400 years, an increasingly egoistic, anti-social mode of thinking has arisen. The anti-social outlook, which comes to expression especially in each person thinking first and foremost of himself, and trying to get as much as possible for himself from the social organism. Few people today have the sense that they must give back to the social organism everything they gained from it. Amongst the governing gentrified classes, especially, the greatest conceivable egoism has gradually emerged in respect of culture and the life of the mind, an egoism that regards mere cultural delectation as something to which those who can procure it are particularly entitled. But we do not have any entitlement to cultural, spiritual delectation afforded us by the social organism, unless we seek, in turn, wherever we stand in the world, to give back to the social organism a corresponding equivalent. It is important to realize this. Now, the proletariat, which has been excluded from participation in the spiritual cultural sphere of the social organism, and is harnessed to economic life and soulless capitalism, has simply drawn the ultimate consequence of this bourgeois egoism in the doctrine of, quote, added value, close quote. The worker sees that it is he who in fact produces what is made in factories, in industry, and so he wishes to have the income obtained for it. He does not wish a part of this value to be deducted and accrue to others. And since he sees nothing more than the capitalist who puts him to work on the factory floor, naturally he believes that all added value benefits the capitalist, and therefore he rises up against the capitalist initially. But objectively speaking, of course, there is a quite different component also in what corresponds to this so-called added value. What is added value? It is everything produced through manual labor, for which the laborer obtains no recompense. Imagine there were no added value, then everything would flow to the needs of the manual laborer. And then, what would be lacking? Self-evidently, there would be no spiritual culture, no culture whatsoever. There would only be economic life, only what can arise and emerge through manual labor. Added value cannot accrue to manual labor itself, but can only be used in a way to which the manual laborer can agree. But this will only come about if the manual laborer is educated to understand the ways in which added value is used, the course it takes in society. Here we touch on the worst violation of modern civil society. Factories and industry were established, trade was established, capital was circulated, laborers were set to work at machines and harnessed to the capitalist economy. They had to work. But no account was taken of wanting anything from the worker other than his labor. In a healthy social organism, besides the worker's labor, his rest must also be wanted and needed. The strength or energy that remains after he has done his work. The only justified capitalism is one that also has an interest in sparing the worker labor as much as in economic utilization of his work. The only justified capitalism is one that ensures that after a certain number of working hours, the worker can in some way access culture and education of a universally human kind. But to achieve this, culture and education must first be available. The middle classes of society developed it and were therefore able to found all kinds of public education institutions. All kinds of cultural education programs of this kind have been cooked up. But what did these cultural breweries teach the proletariat? Only that the gentry were dropping from their table crumbs of culture they had cooked up together. And naturally the workers were mistrustful of this. They thought, quote, they want to gentrify me by feeding me the milk of their piety and manner of thinking in these places. Close quote. All these charitable movements and programs were by their very nature often to blame for the upsurge of alarming realities in society. What is surfacing today rises from much graver depths than people usually realize. Quote, give us the added value that belongs to us, close quote. This is the egoistic principle now appearing as the ultimate consequence of gentrified egoism. The proletariat is drawing the ultimate consequences, and instead of the socialism dwelling in the underdepths of their souls, the intrinsically anti-social doctrine of added value has now appeared at the conscious forefront of their minds. You see, if each person pockets the added value of goods, he is pocketing it for his own egoism. And so today, my dear friends, we have a socialism that is not socialist. Just as we have the quest for a content of consciousness that has no deeper reality, but is just the result of the economic context of one class of people coming to expression in the class consciousness of the proletariat. We have a quest for the spirit that denies the spirit, that has found its ultimate consequence in the materialistic view of history. We must recognize these things. Otherwise, we will fail to understand what lives in the world today. The bourgeoisie has been very disinclined to gain understanding of these circumstances, and although the facts and realities speak forcefully and urgently to us today, they remain disinclined. The only possible way to replace the anti-social strivings of the proletariat today with a truly social striving will be by trying to establish economic life upon its own healthy foundation as a sphere of the social organism with its own legislature and administration, unimpeded by state involvement. In other words, we must try to ensure that the state never engages in economic activity itself in any field. And then the yearning deep in human souls for real socialism can develop in economic life. At the same time, we must aspire to keep economic life separate and distinct from the life of the political state as such, which, for its part, makes no claim either on economic life nor on the life of culture, spiritual life per se, on cultural life, education, and so forth. If this state refrains from interfering in either domain, if it embodies only the life of rights, then it expresses what underpins the relationship between one person and the other here in the physical world, the relationship in which all people are equal before the law. Only a state conducted in this way develops real freedom of thought. And as a third sphere of the healthy social organism, a self-founded life of spirit and culture must develop, one that can also draw sustenance from the reality of the spirit. And that must work its way through to a true science of the spirit. In the depths of human souls today, it is true to say, there lives already a questing for the healthy social organism. But this must in turn inevitably be threefold in nature. Considering things as we have considered them today, we find that spiritual science should be taken very seriously, at a much deeper level than people are accustomed to when listening to a Sunday sermon, which is a comfortable, middle-class kind of attention. It is bourgeois when, alongside one's economic life, which is largely concerned only with one's own little circle, or at least that's what people think, and alongside political life, the life of the state which one leaves to the state to take care of, people develop a little bit of cultural icing on the cake of existence. Depending on their degree of enlightenment, in quotes, they attend church or devote themselves to theosophy or such like. In fact, theosophy has assumed an eminently gentrified air in modern culture. It is hard to conceive of anything more middle class than this modern theosophical movement, which grew very much out of bourgeois needs as a factional spiritual movement. We have been battling to elaborate something from this theosophical movement that could be informed by a modern consciousness befitting humanity and place it into the world at large as an inclusive movement. But we have always met with resistance from the middle-class factional element, which is deeply rooted in the superficial stratum of the human soul. And we have to get beyond this. Anthroposophic endeavor must be seen as something needed by the times we live in, something that should enlarge the scope of our interests, not constrain them, that does not invite us just to gather in small circles and read lectures. Yes, it is good to read lecture cycles. I beg you not to conclude from what I say that you should stop doing so, but this alone is not enough. What you read in the cycles has to be led fully into human life, though not as many imagine, but by first seeking a connection, a relationship with modern consciousness. I am not saying that we should stop reading lecture cycles, stop gathering in cliquish groups and reading them. On the contrary, we should engage in this all the more, but then also take care that the content of these cycles is really integrated into our life forces. This will provide the best social sustenance for questing souls in the modern era. For that is the intention. That is also the intention of our building, particularly in the artistic endeavor inherent in it. It is conceived very much as intrinsic to the modern era, and it is impossible to conceive of it in any other way. I wonder how much you have recognized that this building of ours especially is a product of the very greatest modernity in a social respect also. How the quest to engage with an up-to-the-minute modernity is integral to it. Recall this fact. We have here a building whose interior has no utilitarian purpose whatsoever, or at least a large part of its interior has none in terms of its own isolated structure. It has to stand in connection with the whole of the rest of the world order if it is to have any meaning at all. Even in the daytime it would be pitch black up in the cupola, darkest night, if electric light did not fall upon it from without. The building is entirely dependent on what happens outside it as far as important matters are concerned, such as whether we see anything inside it. It has been born from the very latest modernity, and therefore it has to be connected with what this modernity itself has to strive to attain. But now in a deeper, more inward way, not from a superficial level of the soul. And so you might reflect upon a great many things that are connected with this building. It actually represents the most up-to-the-minute cultural life, and can only be properly understood by conceiving of it as a kind of comet that must drag its tail after it. The tail consists in this, that the felt content of anthroposophy radiating from it should live in human souls. And yet it could easily happen that people begin to relate to this building as a good many Catholics, leading Catholics, in fact, related to modern astronomy when they ordained that comets were natural heavenly bodies, as opposed to the, in quotes, rods they had previously been thought to be, which some kind of spirit, conceived in sensory terms, had held out of the window of heaven. A time arrived when Catholic leaders could no longer claim that comets were of an entirely different order from other heavenly bodies. But they thought of a way out of this problem. Very clever minds among them said, quote, "Yes, the comet consists of its nucleus and of its tail. We cannot deny that its nucleus is a heavenly body like any other, but the tail is not. The tail has the divine origin we previously ascribed to it." Close quote. Similarly, one can imagine that people start to think that the building itself is solid and real enough, but that they don't wish to entertain all the suspect and complex feelings that are meant to be connected with it as its tail. And yet this building and its tail belong together, and what is connected with it will have to be felt to be so. The end of Lecture 4.